Well, as we've been going through this series, it's been a fun one. I enjoy going through this. I like all series because they keep digging into topics a little deeper. We're into the Sabbath in the New Testament specifically. Did anything change? This is a part two of this, two part of this New Testament part. Again, we looked at how many times it occurs, 91 places in the Old Testament, the word Sabbath or Sabbaths, and 60 in the New Testament, a lot of times it occurs. Now, again, we're not going through every single one of these. One of the things that comes up over and over as well in the New Testament, which is interesting but won't be part of this sermon series, is how much it comes up in relation to when Christ was buried and when he was resurrected. And seeing he came up Saturday night and go, oh, well, he came up on Sunday morning. No, that's when they found him and they saw him Sunday morning. But you start to look at the Sabbath being referenced, and specifically the first day of unleavened bread mentioned as well as the Sabbath and those relations. But it's interesting to see how many times, over 60 times, that this word Sabbath or Sabbath occurs. Again, it occurs more because you see rest, we'll see in Hebrews next time, and other places that have a reference to the Sabbath as well. We looked and began to at least looked at these eight principles of the Sabbath in the New Testament, specifically in the gospel accounts. We looked at the first few here. I'll at least mention them, what we went through. The first principle we saw, again, was Christ observed the Sabbath and taught on the Sabbath. Christ observed the Sabbath and taught on the Sabbath. And you think, oh, that's an elementary one, but it's missing in the world. People, oh, Christ came to do away with the Sabbath. He didn't put any significance on it. And yet we see Christ observed the Sabbath and taught on the Sabbath. We also see the second point, the Sabbath belongs to Jesus Christ. He's called the Lord of the Sabbath, and he gave it as a gift to man. Again, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. We saw that in Mark chapter 2. We also see the third point, Christ gave no authority to man's laws regarding the Sabbath. Christ gave no authority to man's laws regarding the Sabbath. And we've seen that, and that's what we'll see basically through each of these remaining ones as well. We looked at the fourth one as well, the reminder to do good on the Sabbath, not evil. And the fifth principle we looked at, and the final one we looked at, again, goes back to do good on the Sabbath, not evil. But specifically, we saw to be untied from Satan. It's a good reminder on the Sabbath. We are to be untied from Satan. Again, goes back to that not doing evil on the Sabbath. So we look at these first five, and we're going to look at the last three, and there's a little bit more length in some of these. That's why it was a good stopping point instead of stopping in the middle. But if you turn over to Luke chapter 13, where we had the last point, because it's interesting, these last, I guess, five points all deal with healing. On the Sabbath, I'll deal with specifically healing and being done on the Sabbath. So we looked at that fourth and fifth points. And we looked at that in Luke chapter 13. Again, one of those emphasis throughout this section of chapter 13, verses 10 through 17. Well, there's a lot in here. Here Christ heals her, specifically someone who had this affliction for 18 years in verse 11. The curvature of the spine in verse 11. And we're going to look at, as it progresses through, we're going to see longer periods that someone had an ailment. And we're going to look at one where it was since he was born, quite a bit in it. And each of these should have been more and more of an opportunity to celebrate and be excited. Ah, God healed. The healing took place. But instead it kept going back to this man-made traditions, man-made laws. And the more and more you look at this subject that Christ keeps dealing with through the New Testament, is people were making the Sabbath an idol. They started making their man-made laws regarding the Sabbath an idol. God gave the Sabbath to be a blessing, something that's to be there, something we are to have. But these man-made traditions of the scribes and Pharisees became this idol. It's important to see that as we look at these remaining three as well, because each of these Christ is getting across, it's not in the scripture. It's not what was intended by the Sabbath. The Sabbath is to be a blessing, something to rejoice in. We see in Isaiah 58 that we looked at through that those first two parts of the Old Testament. You start looking at the blessing of it and man making traditions of, well, you can't do this, 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 this. We can look in our life too. Do we make things a burden on the Sabbath? Do we make things that are not what the Bible says? And to make sure that we are living by what the Bible says. We get to this sixth point as we continue through these eight. If you turn over to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14 and verse 1. As with each of these, we go through the scriptures first, and then I'll give the point as we go through it. Luke chapter 14 and verse 1. Now it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees. So he wasn't opposed to going in and eating with these people. But again, we see the same attitude as we saw earlier last week. He went into the rulers of the synagogue, or the Pharisees, to eat bread on the Sabbath. They watched him closely. Again, this watch here, this word means to observe under close scrutiny. You know, again, you had the opportunity, you have the Son of God here to watch him and learn from him. What was he doing? What can I learn from what he's doing? But not the attitude they had here. They're watching him. Okay, how can we trip this guy up? What can we get against him? Because we want to kill this guy. We've already went through. They're plotting to kill him. And so they watched him closely. Verse 2, and behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. Now, this word dropsy, it's a disease produced by the accumulation of water in various parts of the body. Very distressing and commonly incurable. So you get the picture here that very likely he might even been here at the house eating with them. No small idea that we'll invite this guy over for dinner too and we'll see what he does. Again, watching him closely. Behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus answered, spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, so again, pretty big crowd here, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Christ brings it up before they even get to it. We start to look at this principle, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? But they kept silent. And he took them, and he took him and healed him and let him go. Start to think about the excitement of being healed instantly, no longer having this affliction and this freedom from this disease. Again, is what we saw in the previous chapter with this disease that comes from Satan. So we see, again, this excitement that should have been there into verse 5. Then he answered them. They're going to keep silent. They didn't want to get backed into a corner. Christ asked a perfect question. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And he answered them and said, and saying, which of you having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? And they could not answer him regarding these things. Christ gives the principle of the Sabbath, again, was not to, well, you know, we can't heal on the day. Again, it goes back to what verse says that? We went through the Old Testament scriptures. No place it says, well, you can't heal on the Sabbath. You start to look at this principle that Christ gives, again, of this donkey or ox that's fallen into a pit. This is the verse we normally talk about, the ox in the ditch. Also, Matthew talked about that, one of the verses we looked at earlier in the last sermon. But again, it mentions which of you having a donkey or an ox which has fallen into a pit. Usually we say the ox in the ditch. That's always the phrase that I get in my mind. But this pit is something deeper. It's not just in the ditch. If an ox goes in the ditch, it's going to get out unless it's a muddy mess and it gets stuck. Still the same principle. In the New English Bible, this word here has fallen into a pit. This word for pit actually is well. This word here for pit means a well or pit dug in the earth for water or other purposes. You start to think about a donkey or an ox or a sheep or anything falling into a well, it's not going to be, oh yeah, let's just lift it out. It's going to take a lot of work. And you're going to, again, try to save this animal from drowning. You can't, well, you know, we'll just wait until after Sabbath and then we'll let it out. No, it's going to be dead by then. You're trying to save its life, trying to get it out of there. And so we see this principle, again, Christ is showing there's nothing wrong with healing on the Sabbath. That was his question. Again, here's this common principle they had. They had all these laws. Again, we went through some of those last time, and under this same principle, one of their laws, if a wall fell on a man, you'd check his vitals, make sure, could he make it through until the end of the Sabbath? If he can make it through, then you just wait. If there's life critical, then okay, well, we better go ahead and get him out from underneath this. But we don't want to move a brick because that's working on the Sabbath. Well, if you're a bricklayer and you're moving brick, yeah, you're working on the Sabbath. But a wall fell on a guy. Help him. And you think the same principles. Someone has a flat tire. Well, sorry, it's a flat tire. Can't take care of it. You get a flat tire on the way over. Oh, well, sorry, I guess God didn't want me to be at church. No, you take care of it. Those emergencies come up. Again, we see those that important principle here that Christ gives. Again, this disease that was healed instantly. Christ didn't say, oh, you know, you need to do some rehab here, you need to work on this, and then you're going to have full functionality, but I'm just getting rid of the water. He heals them completely and says, go on your way. Go home. And so we see again this healing that takes place. Now, the sixth principle that we see here from Christ, again, emergencies are to be taken care of on the Sabbath. Again, you start thinking, well, don't push the ox in the pit. But again, it goes back to the question he asks in verse 3. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Is it something, well, we can't anoint people on the Sabbath because, well, it might start the healing process? Baloney. Christ, again, gives this example we see, again, going before God and asking for this healing to take place. Here, again, was this instant healing that took place. You can hold your place here. A couple principles that point back to this. Exodus chapter 23. We see this mentioned in other places in the Old Testament. Christ, again, is not inventing something new. He keeps pointing to the principle of what the Sabbath was. Exodus chapter 23. Exodus chapter 23. In verse 5. Exodus 23 and verse 5. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. It goes through each of these. It goes through the whole section here. It talks about how to deal with things. Again, no clause here. Well, unless it's the Sabbath day. Again, if it was, God would put it in there. Well, except for the Sabbath. Don't worry about that. No. Again, we see that time. Even your enemy to help. To take that time to be there for them. And we also see in Deuteronomy 22, verse 4, two specific places. There's probably others you can think of. Deuteronomy 22, again, it goes back to what Christ asked in chapter 13 of Luke, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? Well, you know, you can do it good other times, but again, not on the Sabbath, not what the scripture says. Deuteronomy 22, in verse 4, Deuteronomy 22 and verse 4, you shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fall down along the road and hide yourself from them. You shall surely help him lift them up again. Again, this process took time, especially as you think about what Christ is talking about in Luke 14 of it falling into a pit or a well. And you think about how do we get this thing out? You can't really put something around its neck, you're going to strangle it. You got to get in there. You got to get some way of getting it out. Or, worst case, you start throwing in rocks to start bringing up the animal, a very slow process. Something that took time. But again, this understanding, again, there are emergencies that take place. Things that happen on the Sabbath that, well, you know, I can't do those. I can't. No, God says to do good. Again, what we saw back in Mark chapter 3 last time, again, to do good on the Sabbath, not evil. Here, Christ gave, again, another example of healing on the Sabbath. Something that they were so against, and yet, what verse says you can't heal on the Sabbath? again, one of these man-made laws and traditions that they had. Back to, I guess, had you hold your place in Luke, but we're not going back to Luke. Back to John chapter 5. We get to the seventh principle. Again, the sixth one, emergencies are to be taken care of on the Sabbath. And specifically, Christ says, you can heal on the Sabbath. Something that he's been going through on each one of these. But his example showed you do good. You take care of those emergencies that come up. The Sabbath is not a burden of not taking care of things and helping people when those instances come up. In John chapter 5, we see the seventh principle here. Here we see another progression. When we looked at the fifth point, again, the lady had this infirmity or this disease for 18 years. You think, wow, what would it be like to have something for 18 years? Here in John chapter 5, we see, again, this principle comes up in verse 1. John chapter 5 and verse 1, after this there was the feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, this is Passover time this referred to, at least we think it is. It's likely his second Passover. There also possibly could be a reference, this might be trumpets. Later on the chapter, verse 21 mentions, as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. Possibly talking of resurrection, and you think about that seventh trumpet. Possibly still talking about Passover time, because that verse could as well talk about unleavened bread and Passover, his death that would be for all mankind. But what we do see is it is a feast day, again, called the Feast of the Jews, but we see this feast day likely then being Passover and unleavened bread. Verse 2, now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. And we heard a sermonette on this a few weeks ago, or maybe a month or two ago, going through this principle. It says, for an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whomever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Again, you start to see some superstitions. You start to see some things that are not in Scripture. Again, this was these traditions. Oh, well, this is an angel. Well, who said? And maybe it was an angel, but was it a fallen angel? Start to see there's mentions of the beast power. They start to look at certain miracles take place that Satan has limited power with. And so was Satan maybe starting to do some of this? We'll see. Were they actually healed, or were they just, oh, I got in there first and, yeah, I feel good. And then when they get home, you see in the Protestant world these healings take place, but you never find out later. Did the guy really get healed, or did he put on a good show and maybe walk a few steps and then not really get healed? Very likely that could have been the instance here. Again, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9, talks about the working of Satan with all power, signs, lying wonders. So this could be that. Again, there's no mention here. Christ also doesn't reprimand him and say, what are you doing? This isn't what's... But again, you look at each of these examples, Christ doesn't reprimand what's being done wrong. He keeps showing the right principles. Starts showing what was to be done. Verse 4 continues, or verse 5, I guess, says, now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. Again, last one we saw was 18 years. Here we have 38 years. What would that be like to have something for 38 years? When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he already had been in that condition a long time, he said to him, do you want to be made well? The sick man answered him, sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming down, another steps down before me. Here he's talking to the person who could heal him, and he's, oh, I don't have anyone to do this for me. Well, Christ didn't say, well, let me help you down. He heals him. Verse 8, Jesus said to him, rise, take up your bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed, and walked, and that day was the Sabbath. We start to see the Sabbath mentioned here. This importance of telling him not just be healed, He says, take up your bed and walk. We see the Jews, verse 10, therefore said to him, who was cured? It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed. So really it goes down to another issue. They didn't like that he was healed. But here we have another issue. We see it is not lawful for you to carry your bed. Well, that's true in one sense. You can hold your place here over in Jeremiah 17, verse 22. It isn't a day for you to order your bed, get it shipped in, get it all set up, and do something that could be done any other day of the week. But is that what was done here? You start to think about judging with righteous judgment, and they were so far removed from that, they couldn't get simple principles through their heads. In Jeremiah 17, we read this going through the Old Testament, hallowing and keeping the Sabbath holy. We see in verse 21, we'll begin, it says, for thus says the Lord, take heed to yourselves and bear no burden on the Sabbath day, nor bring it in by the gates of Jerusalem, nor carry a burden out of your houses. This one would fit perfectly in there. There should be no reason why you have your mattress carried out on the Sabbath day. Unless, again, was this a mattress? Was this a huge bed? Or was this a little cot this guy had to have as he went places? Again, not to carry a burden out of the houses on the Sabbath day, nor do any work, but hallow the Sabbath day as I commanded your fathers. This is where they get this principle, and rightly so. In one regard, you think, well, yeah, we're not going out. He's not, yeah, I'm going to go get my sleep number bed today. I'm going to get it all set up. I'm going to move it from downstairs. I'm going to put it upstairs, maybe even take it outside. I'm going to do all this work that doesn't need to be done on the Sabbath. But not what Christ is approaching here. Again, what took place? Again, their comment in verse 10 again, it is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed. Okay? A statement you could say, yeah, okay, we can definitely see it in Jeremiah 17, verse 22. But what was the principle behind it? We see Christ putting them in their place, verse 11. He answered them, he who made me well, again, talking not to Christ here, this is the man who is healed. He who made me well said to me, take up your bed and walk. And so he starts to push it back on Christ. He's like, well, he told me to do this. We see in verse 12, then they asked him, who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? We've got to find this guy now. This is the guy we've got to get. Verse 13, but the one who was healed did not know who it was. So this is not someone following Christ, not someone who understood, oh, this is the person who's going to heal me. Here is just someone Christ walked by and healed, and he didn't know who he was. We see verse 14, Christ wasn't hiding out and thinking, oh, good, I got away with it. Afterwards, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, see, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you. We see in this instance, Christ specifically says there was sin. Whether that again goes back to him trying to have this superstition, waiting for this pool to be stirred with water and jumping in and maybe be healed at that point. He had misconceptions. He had wrong ideas. And here, whether that is referring to that, we see specifically, sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you. We see this sin that Christ forgives and tells him not to do anymore. And we see this reminder, Christ is not hiding. He's not, well, good, no one caught me. No, he's dealing with the issue. And specifically, he goes back to this individual, quit sinning. Don't do it. He didn't, oh, well, we'll just heal him and let him do what he wants with his life. No, quit sinning. Repent, turn back to God. We see in verse 15, the man didn't really have it all there, because what does he do? He immediately goes back to the Jews. The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who made him well. So in one sense, kind of the snitch, when you look at this story, he's, oh, I got healed. Well, you're not supposed to be carrying your bed. Well, I didn't do it. The guy who healed me did it. And then he finds, oh, it was him. He told me. You don't see much gratitude from this guy. Maybe there was. You don't see any, oh, thank you. Again, you have this for 38 years, and you've been healed. Should have been more joy, maybe? Maybe more gratitude of not even, I'm not going to point him out to the Jews. This guy healed me. But we see, again, the accusations there. We see what takes place. When you look at this story and this understanding, there's so much that keeps going through it. It continues. It doesn't quite end here as it continues through it into chapter 7. Because it's interesting, as you keep reading through it, very likely, again, you probably can't 100% say this, but it seems like Christ is talking back about this situation. John chapter 7, John 7 and verse 21. It's an interesting section here, verses 10 through pretty much the end of this chapter. You start looking at these seven attitudes that are towards Christ here. It looks like, well, he's good. That's talked about in verse 12. Others said, well, he deceives the people. And you start looking at all these things. Verse 20, he has a demon. You see into verse 26, he speaks boldly. We see all these things that were these various views of Christ. And here Christ tells us plainly. We see into chapter 7, verse 21, after he's called, you know, that, oh, he has a demon. Jesus answered and said to them, I did one work and you all marvel. Very likely this is healing that man by the pool. And might still be talking about it. Again, this reference here. Because we see what else he says. You do one work and you all marvel. Verse 22, Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. Again, because God's direction, he said, on the eighth day, if it is on the Sabbath, you still circumcise him on that eighth day. And so he says, here you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. Verse 23, if a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? You're going to start getting into these nuances. Technically, you're cutting this individual on the Sabbath and the healing process starts. You already start to inflict something that then he will then be healed eventually. You're going to start having the scab over process. You're going to start healing or letting the healing process begin. But either way, we see surgery took place. Whether how minor it was when you look at circumcision. But you start to think about, I made a man completely well on the Sabbath. And here you're angry with this. And the crux of the verse here, the whole point that Christ makes is verse 24. Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. You know, you look again at what does the law intend? Jeremiah goes back to, yeah, you shouldn't be lifting burden. You shouldn't be doing all this work on the Sabbath day. It's the day of rest. It's a day of drawing closer to God. All these things we went through in the first two sermons of what the Old Testament shows, Christ, again, is showing this guy wasn't moving his bed around. He wasn't, you know, doing all this extra work. He was healed. And he took his bed home. And this is what you're upset about. First of all, you're upset he got healed. Secondly, you're upset because he carried a burden. Well, it was, but you think it was a little bit joyous to take this little cot back home and I don't have to take this anymore. I've been healed. Again, what Christ emphasizes is to judge with righteous judgment. And this phrase that comes up, and we say it a lot, judge with righteous judgment, specifically relates to the Sabbath and what Christ referred to here. And so we see this seventh principle, again, to judge with righteous judgment. We see what John 5 talks about. He wasn't a man walking around the countryside carrying a bed. He was someone healed and took his bed home. But when you're trying to look for something to try to catch someone with, which is what they were doing, then you're not looking for the truth. And so Christ says, you've got to judge according to righteous judgment. Understand what the situation is. And you think, well, so-and-so, they went into Walmart on the Sabbath. Oh, they're doing all their shopping. And I've met individuals, well, on the road, and they forgot something, and they had to get something so they could get to church. They had to make sure they weren't doing their shopping. But, oh, well, it looks like they're going in and shopping. They're doing this. They're doing that. Again, he judged with righteous judgment. Again, that understanding of what God is talking about. This understanding of looking at the facts. Looking at, well, what was the intent? Are they coming about with a full load of groceries? Was there intent? Was there a reason to judge with righteous judgment? So much of what Christ talks about over and over through all of these 8 points comes back to this point of judging with righteous judgment. The scribes and Pharisees lacked judgment. Well, maybe I should say it. They maybe had judgment. They lacked the righteousness. They could judge, oh, he's doing this wrong, and you're doing that wrong, and you're doing this wrong, and yet you get to Matthew 23, and Christ says, you're worthless. You're blind leaders of the blind. You got the outside of the cup looks really pretty, but inside is filthy and full of dead men's bones. You have example over example. They had judgment, but they didn't have righteousness. They weren't judging with righteous judgment. A fault that is really sad as you look at their examples. Leads us to the 8th and final one. And more of a lengthy one, because it's an interesting story, and I kind of want to paint the whole picture here over in John chapter 9. Because again, we have an example that took quite a while to go through. John chapter 9 and verse 1. John chapter 9. We're down to the last example that Christ gives, so this must be the one he gets rid of the Sabbath. Because we haven't hit any so far. None that he waters down the Sabbath, none that he gets rid of the Sabbath. So this has to be the big one that takes place. Or is it? John chapter 9, verse 1. Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. It's interesting, this very likely we'll see later is the Sabbath. Could be the last great day. What we see earlier in chapter 8 and chapter 7. Of this last great day, and you think about the perfect parallel to the meaning of the last great day, if this is, it seems to correspond, but again, still, we'll see later this Sabbath, this mentioned as well. Verse 2, and his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? So here we see a preconceived idea. The idea is, okay, here's this guy who was blind when he was born. There must be sin. And so there wasn't three questions. There wasn't a question of, well, who sinned, the man or his parents, or was there sin? No mention of that. It could only be two things. Either his parents sinned or this baby that's just coming out of the womb. How did it sin in the womb? But somehow this got in the argument. So this was sin. Why this guy's blind? We don't have any blind people here, but you start to think about, well, if this person's blind, well, you've sinned. What have you done? So there's this stigma already, this preconceived idea. And we see Christ's answer, Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. Quite a statement. As we'll see, this individual is allowed to be blind because he was going to be healed later on. And it was going to be a magnificent healing. And we're finally getting up to this day where God was, this is when he's going to get healed. On this day, God could have easily, well, you know, let's do it on a Monday, a Tuesday, a Wednesday. No, we see what day was picked. But we see neither sin, not the man or his parents, but it was going to be so the works of God should be revealed in him. Something magnificent would happen. Verse 4, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Here Christ talking about while it's safe. You start thinking about this analogy. The night is coming when no one can work. Again, pointing to that troubled time, also reference to end time. You start thinking about how close are we? We're going to start going through the Bible study, and it doesn't look like we'll have it today, but we start looking at who the beast power is, what things lay ahead. and understanding it's still daytime. It's still safe. We don't have to worry about, well, you know, the police found out we're meeting here and we're going to be hauled off to jail or we're going to be killed because we're keeping the Sabbath. There's references to that later on. Very likely that's what we'll come down to in the end time events. We see these times of trouble while it's still day. Make sure you're still working on your character. You're still staying close to God. Don't let the day slip away and then, well, now the trouble time come and now I got to get close to God. It could be too late by then. We've got to make sure we're staying close now. And so it's reference to what Christ is saying. He's got to get this work done while it's still safe. Again, that end time or that trouble is coming when no one can work. This time period that he would have to go through some tough times. We see in verse 5, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva. And he anointed the eyes of the man, the blind man, with the clay. Now you see instance over instance that Christ didn't touch the person. We looked at that last time and healed him. He touches his head, heals him. He goes through different things. And here, he didn't have to make clay. He didn't have to do this at all. He could have just said, boom, your eyes are healed. But again, he was going to go back to a principle of, well, he's working up clay. He's making pottery on the Sabbath. You start looking at these, again, one of these things. Oh, you're making this pottery. You're doing this work. Again, no righteous judgment. And so he spits in the ground, made the clay with the saliva, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Interesting, he didn't immediately receive his sight. Goes back, washes where Christ sent him. So again, we see someone who follows the instruction. He could have said, I got a faucet over here. I got a well over here. I can just wash my eyes and get it out anywhere. No, he follows the specific instructions that Christ gives. We see in verse 8, therefore the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind said, is not this he who sat and begged? What an example. You think about someone that you've known your entire life, and all you've ever seen them is with their cane and stumbling into things and getting around things. And here he's walking. He has no issues with his eyes. He's healed. Verse 9, some said, this is he. Then you have the doubters. Others said, he is like him. You know, he's just his twin. He looks a lot like him. Maybe he's the long-lost twin that finally comes back. He just looks like him. And he says, I am he. Therefore they said to him, how were your eyes open? It's interesting, the first statement. You think about someone coming in, it's like, you can see. Wow, that's awesome. The first statement is, how did this happen? How did this happen? In verse 11, he answered and said, a man, he knew who Christ was, a man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and I received sight. Then they said to him, where is he? He said, I do not know. It's interesting the difference between the last story and this one. The other one, he's over here. I'll point him out and I'll sell him out right now. This guy's very likely, he's not lying. He just, I don't know. Because he had to go down and wash at this pool, come back, and then his eyes are give him sight. And he can obviously say, I don't know what he looks like. He was blind the last time he was by him. And now he's gone, and he knew who he was. But we see this healing, this tremendous healing from birth. It's neat seeing some of the things on Google at times, and you see on YouTube, I've seen some of these people who for the first time can hear, and even some for the first time who get their things removed from their eyes and they have vision. And it takes time. It's even, well, you know, when they go through surgeries, they start to see some light, but their eyes can't handle it. The brain has to to have a little time to adjust. And so they can only take so much, and then it comes back where they can open them a little bit longer, but the brain can't hold it for long, so they have to keep it closed for a little while, and it's a gradual process. Here again is an instant healing. He doesn't go through, well, now you need to do your eye exercises. You need to be looking left and right and up and down. Keep your eyes closed for a little while because they can't adjust all this light. He's healed. And they want to know who did it. Who did it? And so he tells them, or he tells them he doesn't know where they're at, but he gives them the name. And so we see this example again, this healing that takes place. It doesn't end there. It could be in a soap opera. If you ever watch soap operas, this is one of those that just keeps going and going. I don't watch soap operas, but I've seen some, those stories that keep going. This is one that could have just ended there in the excitement, but it doesn't. Verse 13, we see what day it was they brought him who formerly was blind to the Pharisees. Now it's almost becoming a judge, jury, and executioner. Again, if you're not going to do work, why are you bringing him to the Pharisees? Bring him to the Pharisees, verse 14. Now it was a Sabbath. Again, this was the high day. Again, that reference of the last great day. Again, very likely this last great day fell on a Sabbath, where this is mentioned. It was a Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. So not only did he heal, but he also did his pottery class on the Sabbath. And this is what they think. Oh, he made some pottery. He took this clay. He worked it up. And so we see these two things that were against him according to man-made traditions. We see verse 15, then the Pharisees asked him again how he had received his sight. He said to them, he put clay on my eyes and I washed and I see. This is at least the third time that it's mentioned, and we're going to see it get worse as they keep basically interrogating this guy. This guy has been healed, and they're still interrogating him. Verse 16, therefore some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath. Now we have the creator of the Sabbath, the Lord of the Sabbath, accused of not keeping the Sabbath, and not being from God. Others, we see this statement, others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. So we see not all the Pharisees agreed with this. See some of them saying, wait a second, you can't say this guy healed it and he's on Satan's side. This is wrong. So you had some that had sense, and we see this division that was among them. Verse 17, they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him? Because he opened your eyes. What are you going to say about him? We see this man, he says, he is a prophet. We see the first statement that's talked about in verse 11. We see him answer and said, this man says, a man called Jesus. We see the first statement he makes about Jesus Christ is he's Jesus the man. We see the second one here, we see he shows he's a prophet. We see in verse 18, but the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. So here we have this court case going on. This was not some little scuffle. Now let's bring in the parents. Well, how many feet have they walked in the Sabbath? Can they get here without breaking the Sabbath? I mean, you start looking to this production that goes on. So they bring in the parents, verse 19, and they ask them, saying, is this your son, who you say was born blind? Again, the accusations, or are you just, maybe he was fooling you this whole time. How then does he now see? His parents answered and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age, so he's not a kid, he's an adult, he is of age, ask him, he will speak for himself. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. Again, there was this fear because they were the ones that would throw you out of the church, they'd get rid of you. And so we see this fear. For the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So they again called the man who was blind and said to him, "Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner." This man, referring to Jesus Christ. So they're already stating their case. Is this sinner the one who healed you? Well, they think that Christ is a sinner. Verse 25, he answered and said, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see." Here we have people who can see who are blind as bats spiritually. Here was someone physically who was blind. Spiritually, you start to see the eyes opening more and more of, this is the Son of God. And we see this, "I was blind, now I see." Verse 26, and they said to him again, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" This is like the fourth time. You're like, really? I got to explain it again? And we see this frustration. He answered them, "I told you already," verse 27, "and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" I like this guy. He's got spunk. He just tells them right to their face. "You want to be his disciples?" I love this. I look forward to seeing him in the kingdom. And so he tells them exactly the way it is. "I'm sick of answering. I've already told you." Verse 28. Then they reviled him. We see three things that are going to be done to this guy. The first one here, they revile him and said, "You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciple." Okay, again, you see the incorrect thinking here. Again, this reviling, "You can be his disciple," and I'd say, "Thank you, I'll take him." But we see this incorrect thinking on their part. "We're not his disciple, we're Moses' disciple." Well, we see where this is leading them. Verse 29, "We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow," again, what a slap. Here God speaks to Moses. "As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from." The man answered and said to them, "Why, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from. And yet he has opened my eyes." Another insult. I think it's marvelous. You don't even know where he's from, and you're already accusing him. "He opened my eyes. What more do you need?" Verse 31, "Now we know that God does not hear sinners. But if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him." Here's this previously blind man who knew the scriptures. He quotes Proverbs 15, verse 29, as well as Psalms 34, verses 15 through 17. And God doesn't hear sinners. Those who are wanting to continue in sin, God doesn't hear. You think, well, that's harsh. Well, if they're trying to turn back to God, God hears. But we see what the scriptures say. God does not hear sinners. So how can this guy heal me if God doesn't hear sinners? A good argument. So we start to see this argument goes through. Verse 32, "Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind." Again, pointing to this was impossible. No record that anyone who had ever been born blind was healed. Impossible. Again, another record of showing who this person was. Verse 33, "If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." This guy is giving the perfect sermon on this day of pointing to God, pointing to what Jesus Christ did and what God did through him. "If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered and said to him, here's the second thing they do to him, or the second thing they state here. They answered him and said to him, "You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?" We see this second accusations that are thrown at. The first one we see, the reviling of him. Now they are accusing him of being born in sins. Now we don't have to have any doubt. It wasn't your parents. It was definitely you who were a sinner in your mother's womb. What'd you do? Talk back to mom while you're in there? What did you do? Well, we see this accusation, and we see the third one, and they cast him out. They kicked him out of the synagogue, the same as excommunicating him, not allowing him ever back in. It was a big deal. You think, oh, well, it's no big deal. Finally, he's getting the truth. But you think, this was still tough. This is how you came before God. You start to think about being cast out. We see these three things then that were done to him. What I find interesting still is this isn't the end of the story. You look at Jesus Christ, how does he care for you? Well, I'm going through this trial, and I don't know, is God still watching? Does he care? Absolutely. You know, deep down he does, but you can go through those times where, does God care what I'm going through? Here we see Christ, and you think about this attitude. Here he was reviled, he was accused and told that you have sinned since birth, and you're kicked out of the synagogue. You've been excommunicated. Verse 35, Jesus heard that they had cast him out. This wasn't silent. This was something that went out. It was to be humiliating. It was to be public because now this person can never come back. And it had to be clear. It had to be pointed out. We see Jesus heard that they had cast him out. And when he had found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" We see this fourth principle, this mention, or the third one here. We see, first of all, the man says that he's Jesus, the man, in verse 11. We see in verse 17 that he is a prophet. We see now Christ is going to ask him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" He didn't know what Jesus looked like at this point. This is the first time that he has Jesus Christ to see since he's been healed. And here, I find it interesting, again, that Christ comes back. He finds out he's been kicked out, and he doesn't say, "Oh, well, don't worry. He'll figure it out later. I'll talk to him maybe if I bump into him again." Christ comes and finds him and asks him this question. We see in verse 37, and Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." We see this third principle. He understood that he was the Son of God. And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." We see this principle of what Christ is getting across, again, calling out of this world. And unfortunately, there's also those who want to go back into the world, and they'll go back. They don't want to see, and so God will say, "Well, I'm not going to force you. If you don't want to see, stay blind." But we see those that God opens the eyes and again works with, and we see this principle. I love this example here and how he says, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Verse 40 doesn't end there. Then some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also?" And you're like, "Yep." Christ is much more mature than me, sorry. Well, thankfully. But you start to say, "Are we blind also?" Again, they're starting to admit this. See this question. Verse 41, Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, 'We see.' Therefore, your sin remains." It was worse that they weren't blind. It was that they said, "We see," and they weren't. We see them being blind spiritually. If they say, "I see," they said they didn't need Jesus. And this really comes down to the statement that we see through this whole thing. The whole examples we've gone through, each one of these, almost every single one, especially dealing with healing on the Sabbath, they're all looking to accuse. They're not looking to, "Well, how do we keep God's law? How do we keep the Sabbath? What are we to be doing?" They say, "We see perfectly fine just the way we are. We don't need any help." And Christ is like, "You're right. You couldn't have help if you wanted it because you don't want to really see. We see this example of them. Again, we see we need Jesus to help us see. This example through this whole chapter, as we've already covered, is so much of what we need Jesus to help us see. Throughout this example, this eighth point, kind of a sublet of this whole story, and one that is not here but should be. You know, this eighth point is we are to rejoice in the Sabbath. If there was ever a time to rejoice, you think about some guy that's been blind in our congregation since birth, and he's now an adult. He still couldn't see, and God heals him. You think, oh, I can't believe he healed him on the Sabbath. And he was making pottery to boot. Here he's putting clay in his eyes and doing this. It should have been a rejoicing of, come into church. Well, let's thank God for this healing that took place. We see how long, it doesn't say how old he was. He could have been in his 20s, 30s. See, he was of age in verse 21. He was old enough that he didn't have to have his parents talk for him. But we see this whole story, it's kind of sad when you think this should have been a wonderful day of rejoicing. In God's kingdom, it would have been. You think about that healing that took place, healing those eyes. This took place, and it should have been this great rejoicing. Instead, in the Jewish standard, he gets thrown out of the church. You think about how opposite the attitude was and what it should have been. Quite a statement. We see again this eighth principle that we are to rejoice in the Sabbath. When these good things happen, they're to be rejoicing. Not, oh, well, no, I don't know if I should have done that. I don't know. Well, you go back to the Old Testament, what we've been through in those two sermons of what the Bible says. What do we do on the Sabbath? What are we to be living by? There's so many principles, again, that each one of these Christ brings up keeps pointing back to the validity of the Sabbath, the way God made it, to rejoice in it, to live by the Sabbath, keep it holy. He never says, oh, you don't need to keep the Sabbath holy anymore. We're getting away with this. We're doing away with this. No, we see this principle, again, that points to the Sabbath and what it is to be. So we look at each of these eight. And then I wanted to kind of springboard as we finish up the sermon back in the book of Acts, or forward in the book of Acts. Because here we get to the book of Acts, and want to kind of hit it briefly. But each of these, it's interesting going through. If it's been a while since you've been through the book of Acts, how many times God's laws are talked about, pointed to, what we are to live. And so here Christ has died. He's no longer on the earth with his disciples. And so this would be the perfect time for the disciples. Okay, now Christ was talking about the Sabbath while he was here. But when you guys weren't around, he was telling us how after he died, we're getting rid of the Sabbath. And so here's where we're going to bring this out. And so this was the perfect place to bring it out. Acts chapter 13, if that's what was to be done. But what do we see through the entire book of Acts? Acts chapter 13 and verse 14. When they departed from Perga, they came to Antioch in Pisidia and went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. Sitting down symbolized formal teaching. To teach, here's what was to be done, how to live God's ways. Again, went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day. Dropping down to verse 27. Interesting how many times it comes up in chapter 13 alone. Verse 27, for those who dwell in Jerusalem and their rulers, because they did not know him, nor even the voices of the prophets, which are read every Sabbath, have fulfilled them in condemning him. Talk again about this reading on the Sabbath, and what they continually did against Christ. But again, the Sabbath pointed to. Dropping down to verse 42. When the Jews went out of the synagogue, the Gentiles begged that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. Here's Gentiles. Okay, Gentiles now should have got the memo that Sabbath now Sunday. So they should have been asking here, wait, if you've just done away with the Sabbath in the Sabbath sermon, can you just come back tomorrow and preach to us? Because now it's been moved to Sunday. Not what's said. They talked to them and begged them, please come back the next Sabbath. The Sabbath still being kept. Verse 44, and the next Sabbath, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God. Again, the mentioning of the Sabbath over and over. And then the next Sabbath. We see in the chapter 15, verse 21, this isn't just one or two occurrences. It's not a mistake that is here. It's again to show that validity of the Sabbath. Acts chapter 15 and verse 21, or verse, Acts 15 and verse 21 says, for Moses had had throughout many generations those who preached him in every city, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Again, every Sabbath. Not, well, now we've gone to Sunday. We're switching over. No, again, the Sabbath. Chapter 16 and verse 13. Three more here that we'll see throughout this. This is literally every place that we see Sabbath mentioned throughout the book of Acts. Chapter 16 and verse 13. See Lydia baptized, verse 13, and on the Sabbath day, we went out of the city to the riverside where prayer was customarily made. And we sat down and spoke to the women who met there, again, on the Sabbath. We start to go through the section on Lydia and her baptism, encouraging. But again, when does it begin? On the Sabbath, where they preached, where they talked, where they taught about God's ways. We see in chapter 17, verse 2. Chapter 17 and verse 2. Then Paul, as his custom was, went in to them and for three Sabbaths. You know, why waste your time? Well, why have to wait three separate Sabbaths? No, for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the scriptures. Again, this emphasis on the Sabbath, not done away. Chapter 18 and verse 4. Final one we see here, where specifically we see the word Sabbath or Sabbaths. We see again Paul referred to, and he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. Not just the Jews, but we also see the Gentiles. We see again this reasoning with them, teaching that takes place on the Sabbath. Over and over again, this mentioning of what the Sabbath is. We get to the end of this second part of this two-part of the New Testament, and as we went through the first two parts of the Old Testament, what the Sabbath was. Not a single place that Christ, well, you know, now we're in the New Testament, now it's time to do away with things. He keeps pointing to the validity of the Sabbath. So it's a good place as we think about, again, reminding what Christ taught, what the Sabbath is, what it still is, what we are to be living. So we think about those principles, the seven that we looked at in the Old Testament and the eight that we looked at in the New Testament, of what those principles are, what we are to be living, what the Sabbath is. Still holy, still created since creation, still there for man and not man for the Sabbath. Not man to make all the little, well, I think this, here's all the things I think should be added to the Sabbath. We're to keep the Sabbath the way God intended. As we see what that is, as we've gone through in these sermons. Not a single place that is ever done away. Getting, well, you know, we're going to water it down. God really didn't know what he was doing when he created it. Now we're going to put it on Sunday. Not a single mention. So that will lead us up to next week, as we're going to look at the final one in this series, as we're going to look at the arguments against the Sabbath. There are those few that come up. There's one in Colossians that talks about, so let no one judge you in food or drink or regarding a festival or new moon or Sabbaths. Well, this one finally does away with the Sabbath. And we'll look at that one, as well as there's one in Galatians. You observe days and months and seasons and years. We see other places, Hebrews we'll look at as well, about the rest and what it is. Well, that's the one where you get rid of it. You don't need it anymore. But what does the Bible say? We want to make sure that we look at both sides. We're not, well, we're only going to pick the verses we like about the Sabbath because those are the ones we like. We're going to go through all of them, and that's what we've done. We've gone through those already. We're going to continue, well, what are the ones that they say do away with it? Because we're not just picking and choosing the verses we like. We're taking all the verses together and with them all together, it makes perfect sense. What was being referred to? What is the issue being dealt with? What is God say, continue to say about the Sabbath? So we see Christ did not water down the Sabbath or do away with it. He continued to observe the Sabbath and point to its importance the way God had made it. What he preached against was the legalism of mankind, continually, the things that were added to it that were not to be there. Let's be sure we continue to keep the Sabbath holy and treat it the way God intended.